Apparently, I am a grateful and enthusiastic cookie, and my name is Richard. You know, I've already said a lot about Jack this weekend, just mainly because of the content of the stuff we were talking about. So I don't have a whole lot to add to that, other than a couple things. One is I was watching Jack today when Mike was talking. And when Mike got to the part about the Kevin Costner movie, right, I saw the wheels starting to spin for Jack, and I'm pretty sure when he gets back to LA, he's going to be working on a proposal for a new movie about an intrepid Al-Anon member who goes to lots of open AA meetings. Working title: Dances with Drunks. The other thing I can tell you about Jack is that in the time that he's been my sponsor, I've had the opportunity to spend time with him here and at a couple of events in Prince Albert, and I've been able to visit him at his home a couple of times and watch him with his family, and I've been able to go with him to his home group, the world-famous La Cañada Thursday Night Men's Stag Al-Anon meeting. 7 o'clock, let's rock. And watch how he interacts with the guys there and the other men that he sponsors. And the line that comes to me from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that line where how what we find here is a design for living that really works. You know, Mike talked about it a little bit today, and others have talked about how this becomes a way of life. And Jack, more than anybody I've met, lives this life. He's a father, he's a business owner, he's a husband, but the most prominent thing that I see about him is that he is a spiritual traveler, he's a member of Al-Anon, and that affects everything else that he does. And with that, I would like to call my sponsor, Jack C., up to speak.
I'm a grateful, enthusiastic, and very, very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Jack Carpenter.
Hi, Jack.
I like the way you do that. They do at home, back home, they do that for the Alateens. And then they follow it with, "We love you lots and lots and lots and lots," at the Alateen meetings or when the Alateens speak at a conference like this. I'm really excited to be here. The reason I'm here this weekend is specifically because of Richard and Karen. I've been asked a couple of times how often I go out on the road to do this for the fellowship. Most of the time I go to Alcoholics Anonymous conventions with Al-Anon participation. I'm privileged to go there and tell my story. And by prior agreement with my sponsor and with my wife, we agreed that I don't take any more than one of these commitments a month. That one a month is can be 10 to 12 times a year. That's a big commitment to be away from your family, particularly my family with the things that are going on, and I'll probably get to that in a minute. I'm here, this is my second week in a row on the road because this was an opportunity to come here and be with Richard and Karen. And then the added treat after I was asked was they asked Richard to be your opening speaker, and we got to share a couple of workshops. You know, for me as a guy who's really busy and committed in Al-Anon, I sponsor a lot of guys. That's a rare treat. It really is. So thank you, Richard, for inviting me out. And Richard has been my host, and I think I've been his. We've hosted each other all weekend. He's driven me all over. I have no idea where we went. We kept winding up at hardware stores. I don't know what that's about. I won't go there, but I kind of get lost. I'm like a kid in a candy store going, I want one of them, and UPS will ship that one to me, and stuff you can't get at home because we don't have any farm supply stores near my house in L.A. And I'm going to take the liberty of finishing a story that I started and didn't finish during the last workshop. And I talked about Bill Wilson when he got sober. And the concept of one alcoholic working with another alcoholic to maintain his own sobriety did not come from Bill. It did not come from Dr. Bob. It didn't come from early of the AA members. What happened is Bill Wilson had his white light experience in Towns Hospital. He sobered never to drink again. Incidentally, Lois was called to the hospital again. This is his fourth stay. She was finally showing up at the hospital for the first time, willing to tell Dr. Silkworth that he was right, and she was ready to sign the papers to commit Bill, because there was no hope for him ever stopping drinking, and for his own protection, it was time for them to permanently institutionalize him. That was the setting of that stay in the hospital. And Lois said later in her writings that when she walked in and saw Bill, the first moment she saw Bill, she knew at that instant that he would never take another drink. She just knew. He'd made countless promises. He had signed in her Bible three or four times swearing, "I'm so sorry this happened. I swear that I'll never touch another drop and it will never happen again." And he meant it every time. And by the fourth stay in Towns Hospital, Lois knew that he meant it, but he just couldn't do it. And she realized he would never drink again. Bill set about carrying the message to other alcoholics. He knew that what he had needed to get out, because it was an enormous experience for him. And for 6 months, 4 to 6 months, he spent dragging drunks out of alleys and off of bar stools to share the good news with them that they didn't have to die of their alcoholism in the street, that there might be another answer. And none of them sobered up. They ran away. They stole from Bill and Lois, who didn't really have very much. One of them chased Lois around her own kitchen with one of her own knives out of a drawer. They would escape, and Bill would chase them down. And it wasn't working. This was a critical moment in the history of Al-Anon and AA. Bill walked up to Lois in their little house on Clinton Street and said, "I give up. It's not working. I've done everything I know how to do, and not a single one has stayed sober." Lois Wilson said something that changed the face of the planet. She said, "No, Bill, you're wrong. One person has stayed sober." And the idea of one alcoholic working with another alcoholic to maintain his own sobriety came from Lois Wilson, non-alcoholic wife of the founder of AA. What we do in Al-Anon, as you heard shared at the workshops today, and particularly the sponsor workshop, is exactly that. It's one person working with another person. It's not my business whether anybody benefits from what I say or what I do or what they see. What's important is I make myself available to do it, and somehow or another the quality of my life gets better. This is an adult child conference. I'm going to do a little qualification lead in and tell you what my house looked like when I grew up. There was an awful lot of stuff going on. It was a very busy house. We were the hub for activity in most of my family, which is really shot through with alcoholism. That makes for very exciting times. If your drug of choice, like my drug of choice, is adrenaline, it was a great place to grow up, but it was somewhat unpredictable and largely unsafe. And there were things going on, like my father, who could not get out of bed in the morning to go to work. My mother would bring coffee into my dad at the bedside table and bring him. The rule was that 3 to 4 cups of coffee had to go cold on the nightstand while she begged him to please get up so he wouldn't lose his job before he would get up, and he would lose job after job after job. As a result of that, we spent a lot of time moving and changing our last name to get the power turned back on or the water turned back on, because they had turned it off again because we weren't paying the bills. My father had a little problem where he was a serial cheater on my mom. And he at one point in our house, I remember vividly, my mother actually catching my father in bed with her best friend in the house. And my father talked his way out of that. He said things that, if you go to Al-Anon like I go to Al-Anon, you may have heard this. He said things like, "Are you going to believe me or your lying eyes?" And this look of doubt would come over my mom, and she wasn't sure what she saw or what was really going on. That mom, with her girlfriends, was always plotting and sneaking around trying to catch dad at whatever he was doing. And this is what conflict resolution looks like at my house, is that my mom, my stepmom, and my father had a fight one day. We were little kids, and firearms were a frequent feature in our home for use as conflict resolution. And they were having a fight, and it was one of those fights where, if you grew up in a home like I grew up, is when the kids become invisible, where you're trying to make the smallest carbon footprint you can possibly make, because woe be you if you draw the attention or the anger of any of the combatants, because they're so frustrated trying to deal with each other unsuccessfully that you don't want to be next in line. And we learn to be invisible little kids. And Mom, that night, they were fighting in the kitchen. Mom got to the gun first. Dad had a nickel-plated 1911 slide-action 45, an old military pistol. My stepmom got to that first, and she marched in the kitchen and marched right up to my dad while we were cowering in the living room and pointed in his chest and pulled the trigger. And it didn't go off. And she looked at the pistol and she said, "This thing's broke." And my dad said, "Well, let me see that." He snapped the safety off and he fired a round through the wall into the neighbor's house, which we weren't very popular with our neighbors at that point. And he handed it back to her. He says, "No, it seems to be working fine." And they laughed. That could have gone either way. But they laughed and nobody got shot and nobody died. And we all laughed, that nervous kind of laugh that you just cheated death one more time. That's a terrible way to grow up, being invisible and hiding out and with the threat of violence and death around you without any forewarning this stuff would happen. And my biggest resentment when I came into Al-Anon, the biggest one I ever had, and this was a lot of years later, was against my father for the way he treated my mother and for the way he treated all of his subsequent wives and girlfriends, because he was unfaithful to all of them with each other. You know, that one that tried to shoot him in the kitchen, he married her. They went off together and he married her. And then he was cheating with my biological mother. And she found out and tried to chop down Mom's front door with an axe. Another time she showed up and my mom and dad were together and she got a pool cue and beat my biological mother around the head with a pool cue. This was just everyday stuff in my family. Now I'm about to say something that's going to confuse the hell out of you. First of all, can anybody identify with what I've just described? Give me a couple of hands out there that sounds a little bit like what happened to you. My parents did not drink. My parents suffered from alcoholism. There's absolutely no doubt. I suffered from alcoholism. I do not have the disease of alcoholism because I don't have the physical allergy to chemical alcohol, but I stand before you as a person who suffered from the disease of alcoholism as it affected me through the people that I cared about. Both of my parents, sick and crazy and twisted and as violent as they were deeply affected by the alcoholism, and their parents, it was the same as if they were drinking in our home. The fact that they didn't drink gave me some confusion when I got to you until I began to understand that I was, you'll pardon my language, I was batshit crazy by the time I got to you guys. I was just nuts. My sense of reasoning, my ability to try and solve problems and resolve conflicts greatly reflected my upbringing. I've got no other tools to deal with. That was alcoholism. And I don't drink. I've never been a drinker. And my parents were so affected by their parents that this was the best that they could do. And one of the things that's really interesting, and I'm still processing this, it happened last week. I was flying to Kentucky to do another conference. And on the plane, I watched documentaries on my iPad because my wife and I and my daughters will watch movies. They don't like documentaries, but I really do. And I watched an extensive documentary on cancer. And the first 2 hours I watched on the plane going there was about pediatric cancer and treatment. And they interviewed subjects and kids, some of whom survived and some of whom didn't. And I was paying careful attention to the parents, because there was something going on in me and I needed to watch that, and there was some information that I needed. And here's what I'm going to tell you that happened to me on that plane. My remembrance as a child was that my father had nothing to do with us when we were kids. Until we became old enough to do things that interested him, he was basically absent from our life. When I got old enough to ride rodeo and to ride horses and to race motorcycles and do things that he could do and he was interested in, suddenly I had a father in my life. And I came to you guys believing that he'd been an absent father and that he wasn't worth the powder it take to blow him to hell. But what I will tell you, and some people here know this, when I was 16 months old, I pulled a cord on an electric percolator in the kitchen of our little home. My dad was home. My mom was gone. He was getting ready to go out, and a babysitter just showed up. And I pulled a cord on an electric percolator, and I suffered third-degree burns over half of my body. And I was taken to the hospital, and they told my parents that my burns were so severe that I probably would not survive and that they should go home and wait for a phone call. My parents didn't go home because parents don't go home. They stayed in the hospital day and night for weeks until I got out of the incubator, which was to put me on pure oxygen to stem the possibility of infection. And then they lived with me through 2 years of really painful, really difficult skin graft surgeries, none of which, by the way, do I remember. I don't remember any of this, thank God. Apparently, I remembered it then. I know that from talking to my parents about what happened. And I'm watching that documentary and seeing the people dealing with the fact that their kid's on the ward, taking drastic chemotherapy, having surgeries, the possibility and likelihood that their child might not survive, being told that the child might not survive. And the other piece of the story for me is that I've got a daughter, I mentioned her this morning, who drowned in an accident when she was 1 year old, and she did not die. She wound up in Children's Hospital, where my wife and I, my first wife and I, spent round the clock 24 hours a day doing just what those people did on the documentary. And I identified thoroughly with the interviews I did with them, with that helplessness, with being confronted with, you have to make an important medical decision. The outcome of your choice, A or B, could have devastating effects on what's going to happen with your child, and these people have got to make those choices. And I did that. And it never occurred to me that my parents had to do that when I was in that hospital. My father, who I believed had been absent from my life until I was 10, 11, 12 years old and could do what he did, had lived that in the hospital. Now, with your help of you guys and with rigorous inventory, I made amends to my dad before he passed away. As a matter of fact, we were really good by the time he got sick with cancer, and I wound up going there doing what Richard talked about this morning. I went to the hospital not to grovel, not to make it all about me, because I've got a lot of fear and pain around losing my dad. I went there to be of service to my father and my family. And I wound up, as a side story, my father and my family never did anything religious or spiritual. We were essentially told when we were little kids a profound fact, which is there is no God, and you are on your own, and you're all alone. Figure it out. That was the message I got from that family. And because of you and because of the step process and the amends process, I had already made amends to my dad, and I got to share spiritual stuff with my father in the hospital. One of the things, interestingly enough, that I shared with him, which he was really quite fond of, was the third step prayer from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He could understand that, and it gave him great comfort. I'm gonna jump out of that family. I did that just to demonstrate the fact that even though I didn't have alcoholic parents, that I, like everybody in this room, was affected by alcoholism, which went ripping through my house like a freight train in the absence of the presence of the chemical. I heard it AA early on that alcoholism can exist in the absence of the presence of chemical alcohol. My wife has been sober. My beautiful wife, Leslie, sends you her greetings. I was on the phone with her just before we sat down to eat. I'm here at her good graces. She has to pick up the slack when I'm gone. Celebrated 27 years of sobriety in AA this last July. She's a woman who would have been dead, at least dead, 26 years ago or so. She was a woman, alcoholic. My experience is that women tend to deteriorate much faster than men in the disease. And she was at the very bottom of her drinking, and it was either die or get sober. And she's been sober from that day to this. Send you her greetings. And greetings from my home group, which is the 7 o'clock Let's Rock Men's Stag Al-Anon meeting in La Cañada, where we get 100-plus guys every week at a Men's Stag Al-Anon meeting. We have child care upstairs. I've never been anywhere in the world where a Men's Stag even had child care. I think we might be the only one. And the reach of that group extends around the world. We have groups that have been started in Europe based on the format that we do at our group. And we post our speakers. We have a speaker once a month. We post our speakers online, and they will listen to the speakers. They know all of us because they've heard all of us talk from the podium there. And then they will base their meeting around what they heard on those talks. That group casts a long shadow. And I'm here talking to you, and I travel around the country, and I'm going to tell you I'm a little fish in a big pond in that group. There are giants in that group, people that sponsor like I do, a lot of people who do service. There's former delegates and area chairmen and DRs and GRs and convention chairs, and that group is full of those people. And the reason the recovery is there is because there's people in there that do that and model it for the folks that are coming along to follow them and do service. I don't want to get too far lost, and I really don't want to go over my time. I think that's rude. My old sponsor told me that no souls are saved after 60 minutes. So we'll do our best to keep it to that, although I seldom do. I might go over a couple of minutes. Depends on where I am in my story. I came to you with the benefit of a wife who had already gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife had a year and a half of sobriety before I darkened the doors of Al-Anon. There's a very good reason for that, is because her drinking could not have driven me to you. When my wife was involved in the active disease of alcoholism, I was good. I got it figured out. I'm ahead on points every day. You remember the point system? Oh, I love the point system. She was always screwing up. I was always ahead on points. She would never catch up, no matter how hard she tried. I got way all the points on my side. She got sober in AA, and they abolished the point system. Did you ever notice that the person who decides that we need to do away with the point system is always the one who's behind? I'm just saying. She came home. She said things like, screw guilt, and I'm sorry you're having a bad day. And she was sloganing me, actually. The reason I finally went to Al-Anon is because that bitch was sloganing me. Well, how important is it? I went to Al-Anon so I could get some slogans and slogan her back. Turn it over. I went to Al-Anon on a resentment. I did a lot of things on that. I'm a guy who, and I don't want to get lost in the early story, I'm a guy who came out of my house as I discovered before I was old enough to take a legal drink that drinking didn't work for me. Drinking didn't do for me. The circumstances in my life, and particularly the circumstances now, were such that if I were to derive the benefit from alcohol that my wife derived when she drank, that my brothers and sisters still get when they drink alcohol, that ability to cope with anything and make the world all right, if it did 10% of that for me that I see it do for all of them, I would be drunk right now. To my horror, I found out alcohol didn't do for me what it did for them. First of all, I never enjoyed a blackout. I would have given anything for just one blackout. Is that too much to ask? One blackout. I drank a lot of booze. I remembered everything. It was awful. I'd make an ass of myself. And the projectile vomiting, that was attractive. And, you know, lay in bed, throw up straight up, and be helpless to do anything before it comes back down. And be there for it. You know what I mean? Like be there and remember it vividly as I'm cleaning the dried muck out of my hair. By the time I'm 21, drinking's done for me, and I'm screwed, man, because everybody in my family, except for my parents, everybody I'm hanging with, all my homies are about drinking and drugging. It's the 60s, it's the 70s, it's what we're doing. If you're not doing that, you're a narc. And that's what they did, and I couldn't do it. Here's another interesting area where I don't measure up. You know I'm not enough in here. All my life I've known there's this spot in me that if you see, you will reject me, and I'm screwed. I've got to keep that from you, and I've got to change your mind about that conclusion. And I can't even tell you that drinking doesn't work for me, so I've got to have another job to be useful for you. I'm the guy that they call when there's trouble. Mostly my brothers and sisters, frequently the guys that I hung with. Jails, fights, you know, Donnybrook's fires, explosions, whatever's going on. They don't call 911 in my family. We found out when you call 911, the police show up, and the downside of that is they're probably looking for somebody who lives there. So we don't be calling the police when there's an emergency. I am the emergency dial on everybody's phone in my family, no matter what happens. If somebody's inventory needs taken, I'm your guy. If we need to give them a good talking to, I'll lead the posse. We'll take care of that. I'm deriving value from what I can do for those people in my life. And I won't tell you the story because I've told it before. I've told it in Saskatoon. But there was a night when I got a call because my brother got in a fight and firearms were involved, and I went and defused the situation. And by the end of the night, I was in an altercation where there were eight guys against the two of us, and I tried to kill some of them with my car because I was afraid if I didn't take two or three of them down in a wreck by impacting their car with my car that I wouldn't survive fighting eight. And I had that plan thoroughly in motion and was closing in on them fast when my brother's voice came over my CB radio and said, I don't think that's them. Oh, yeah. Love him, but not so much that night. And my life was full of incidents like that, and there's a lot more I can tell you. But the reality is that what happened to me and a primary part of my story is that little girl drowned when I was working. I was fresh out of the Marine Corps. I was new in the motion picture business. I was working, my then wife was working at a hardware store to make ends meet, and a 16-year-old babysitter wasn't watching my kids. And my year-and-a-half-old little girl, she was a year old, drowned in a foot-and-a-half-deep plastic pool in the backyard while the babysitter was watching TV talking on the phone. She lay in a coma for a year. After 6 weeks in the hospital, they asked her to leave. They asked us to take her and put her in a state institution. What they were saying was she wasn't going to get better, and we need the space here for critical care patients, and they announced that they were putting her out, basically. And my then wife, who is also the adult child of an alcoholic, her father suffered from alcoholism, I believe, and he eventually took his life with a rifle. He put a rifle in his mouth and blew his brains out behind the discomfort of that and emphysema. Made the decision that we were not going to turn that child loose, that we would take care of that child, and now so the hospital, we're taking her home. And we contacted charities and other organizations where we could get the sufficient medical equipment to take care of a child in a profound coma with heart monitors, breathing machines, suction machines, which was one of my least favorite and my worst memories, to take care of a child who's got a feeding tube in her stomach and the double wall trach tube in her neck, requiring 24-hour-a-day constant care to take care of that child. Now, I'm a guy by this time who has a reputation that if you're in the bar and they start breaking the tops off of bottles and it's going to get busy, you want somebody who's as seemingly brave and crazy as me watching your back. I mean, that's what my story looks like, wading into fights with my brothers with eight guys against two. I got my back broken with crowbars and bumper jacks when I was 17, rescuing my brother in a gang fight. I went in to 8-2 with my dad to go save my brother. That looks like a lot of courage. But that piece of baggage that I mentioned today that I drug into the inventory process with my sponsor was this. That thing that I brought with me, knowing full well that you did not have tools to fix it. You can't fix what's wrong with me. Booze didn't fix it. Drugs didn't fix it. I had a firm belief that counseling, psychiatry, psych meds, nothing was going to fix that. Was the guilt I had because during the entire year that child lay in a coma by my side of the bed, I did virtually none of her care because I couldn't do it. I remember vividly standing at the foot of her crib and watching her struggle to breathe with that little piece of mucus that comes and goes out of their throat that's always there. And even though she's in a coma, she's trying to clear her airway. There's an obstruction to her airway, and she'd blow it out and suck it back in on the next breath, and you'd be trying to catch it with that damn suction machine, and you could never get all of it. And hear the heart machine and the breathing monitors and the suction machine, and the feelings would get up to here just below my eyes where I knew they were about to get loose, and I have to go. I can't stay in the room. No matter how big it is, no matter how important it is, no matter how much I want to, I can't stay. There's a piece of me that believes that if it gets that last quarter of an inch and gets out, it's over. Nobody said that to me. I had no basis in fact to believe it. My belief is that if it had gotten away from me, my life as I knew it would end and I had to go. That wife did 100% of that child's care for a year because I couldn't be enough of a man to be a father and a husband and a co-caregiver with my wife for that child. And as I said, when I came to you and I was here in the process of the steps and I was beginning to work my way up to and through the inventory process, I absolutely knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that you couldn't fix that, but I brought it. And when I got to the end of my inventory and I dropped that news on my sponsor, I found out that I was wrong. That you do have tools for dealing with that. They're not the ones that I would have liked. They didn't have the instantaneous effect, and they weren't done when I thought they were done. That's important. When I put that little girl in the ground in 1977, I never went back to the cemetery. I never talked about it. I never thought about it. I have no tools to deal with what happens to me when the feelings come. I've got nothing. I can't go there. Now, if you're like me and feelings are a threat to you, you throw the switch. You shut them down. There's a problem with that. It's great. I don't feel the pain. I'm in total denial. It's as if it never happened for me. But that switch controls all of them. My ability to really connect with another human being is attached to that switch. My ability to really care about another or love another human being is attached to that switch. My ability to experience joy is attached to that switch, and the only safe position for me is off. When I came to you, I was shut off. I used to wonder what it would feel like to lose somebody that was important to me. I wonder how I would feel because I couldn't imagine feeling anything. And when I came to you, courtesy of that wife who was newly sober in AA and had screwed up all of my plans, I did that process with my sponsor, and I went up on my bicycle. I rode up to the cemetery. It's up a hill a couple miles from where I live. It's a pretty good long bicycle ride to get there. And I sat on that daughter's headstone where I had not been in 15 years. And I read an amends letter that was drafted with the help of my sponsor to try and clean up something I didn't think was cleanable. I went back every week for several weeks to finish that up, and I talked to her and I talked to God, and I got myself right size in that relationship with her, and I cleaned up to the best of my ability, did everything my sponsor asked of me, and it cleaned out a large part of what was wrong with me, but it wasn't done. God's got another plan for that, and I'll get to it in a minute. I will also tell you, just so that you understand who it is you're dealing with, that when that daughter died, I never went back to that house. I stayed gone in my business in those days. It was easy. 8, 6, 8, 10 months a year, I'm gone. I don't even call home. I completely withdrew myself from that marriage. And I would have told you with a virtual certainty that when that marriage finally fell apart at the end, that it was mostly her fault, because my disease said things to me like, she doesn't love me enough and love me the right way, so I go other places. Remember, I talked about rationalization and justification. Those are primary components of my ability to take actions which are not really actions that I should be taking, but those ideas allow me to do that. And while I was out there tearing it up around the country, I was acting just like my dad, who I hated. I did the same things my dad did. I went out and acted like I was single, and I piled up a lot of wreckage, and there was a lot to clean up by the time I got to you. One of them managed to stay with me. I was on a movie in Arizona, and I met Leslie, my beautiful wife Leslie, on a movie, still married to my wife. And when the movie was over, I went home, and Leslie came out to California, trying to run away from her alcoholism, and called me up for a date. And I went out to find her, and it's a long story, but I'll shorten it. I couldn't find her. She came looking for me in her car and had a head-on collision drunk with a full-size Oldsmobile in an intersection about 40 miles from where I live now, and died in the wreck. And when I came across the scene, there was full-blown ER crew there. The cops were there, fire department, paramedics, ambulance. They had the jaws of life trying to peel the door open. There was a blonde inside who wasn't breathing, and they were in a hurry to get her out and try and save her life. And that was the lovely Leslie. They got her heart started and loaded her in a car and took her to the hospital. And I still remember following this desert. There's nothing for miles. It's flat as a piece of paper. And following that ambulance across the desert, red lights and sirens right behind him going to a hospital. I didn't know where it was going to be, and I still don't know where it is now, to follow her to the hospital. And we got inside, they rolled her in, they put her in a room, and we're waiting for the doctors to come see her. She's got broken bones. She can't move. She can't lift a wrist off of the counter. She can't talk. She ate the steering wheel with her throat and the windshield with her face. She died already in the wreck. And we're sitting in there waiting, and she stops breathing. And I run out in the hall, and I call a nurse, and they call a code on the PA, and the blue lights over the door start flashing. They're hollering, code blue, room 7, code blue, room 7. They bring the crash cart in. They get her heart started again. And I'm in the room while this is going on. They're like, I don't exist. They come in, they're too busy to pay attention to me, and I've got a front row seat to it. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, you know, as dates go, this one sucks. And they revive her. And I will never forget, I hope I never forget, that she's laying on the gurney, I'm off to the side, and she rolled her head over on the gurney, and she saw me, she opened her eyes and saw me, and she said, let me go. She said, let me go. I have a limited understanding then and now of a disease that I don't suffer from. I dismiss it as the delirium of the impact. She was clearly inebriated as well, and I just dismissed it until many years later, when she was into sobriety and I had joined you. I understood for the first time that what she was doing was, I got just a peek, just the door open and shut really quick, to how awful it is to be in the active disease of alcoholism for just a moment. I got to see what it was like to have a disease that I don't have. They threw her out of that hospital. She had no insurance, private hospital, sorry, got to go, didn't set any of her bones, loaded her in my car with a neck brace, wheeled her out in a wheelchair. She's got no place to go. The nurse says, I hope you live near a hospital. She's not doing very good. I said, oh, thanks for sharing. Don't know what to do with her now. Never found out where she lives. We've still not found that place. That was 31 years ago. We still don't know where she was staying. She can't find it. I don't know where it is. We're debating what to do with her. And she says, she whispered to me. She says, you can take me to a hotel. I knew it would happen at a hotel. I'd be watching the papers tomorrow to see they'd found a Jane Doe dead in a hotel somewhere. That was unacceptable. So I put my hand on top of hers. I remember I had these red seats in my El Camino, and I put my hand on top of hers, and I said, it's all right, honey. I got a better idea. I'll take you home. Do you all want to think about that for a minute, or did you forget I got a wife and family at home? Yeah, I'm that guy. I'm not Hannibal Lecter, but I went to a phone booth to call that wife, that first wife, and I told her a lie. I said, I'm bringing a friend home who's been in a wreck. She met us in the driveway, and we carried her through the door. I apparently dropped her. She will tell you if you ask her. He dropped me coming through the door, thought I would die. I have no memory of that whatsoever. Might have been a little nervous bringing the girlfriend home to meet the wife and kids for the first time. We put her in bed, and we watched her around the clock for 3 days, waiting for her to die. We fully expected something to happen. It was pretty bad, and she started to recover, and it set up 6 months of some very interesting living, where my wife and my girlfriend are now becoming friends. And my girlfriend, who now likes my wife is confiding to my girlfriend that she thinks there might be some problems in the marriage. And my girlfriend takes it upon herself to give my wife little helpful hints on how to spice up the relationship. And I'm trying to get my girlfriend to mind her own business. It's busy, but it's not unmanageable yet. 6 months she was there, she began to get better. She wound up, we got her a car again, and she started looking for a job and got a job in Texas, went off to Texas, and I thought I'd never see her again. And I set about doing something I had been too much of a coward to do before that and dissolved a marriage I hadn't shown up for a long time. That was a serious amends. That was my first and my most major amends that I made after I got to step 9 with the help of that sponsor, was an amends to that wife. And even she noticed the difference in me by that time, and I won't go there. Leslie was in Texas for 6 months, which was about the time period that she would be able to get by with her alcoholism before she'd get in trouble and lose the job. Called me up after 6 months, had lost another job, and asked if she could come back to California. And I went and got her, and I put her back in my house, and I got to spend the last year and a half of her active drinking with her. And it was just madness. I never knew what was going on. You know, she's a closet drinker by this time. She's an everyday blackout drinker, which is the best thing that ever happened to me. Oh, it still makes me feel warm all over, that when you got a blackout drinker at home, anything that goes wrong has got to be her fault. Just saying, I wake up spring-loaded in a pissed-off position. She must have done something last night. She doesn't remember, and she's sorry. If she's sorry, you got control of everything. You got the checkbook. You got the social calendar. And God help us all, that last thing I gave up in recovery, you have the TV clicker. Oh, that was hard. Oh, that was hard to give up. And she screwed up my plans. I came home to throw her out. She'd embarrass me with my family one more time. We'd been playing bottle tag for a while by that time. And apparently what I said to her, and I have no memory of it, I do not doubt that it's true, is at some point during that period I told her, she said to me that she thought she was an alcoholic and that she didn't think she could stop on her own. And this is the level of arrogance I brought to you. Apparently what I said to that woman was, if you get help from anybody besides me, you are out. I really have no memory of that. I don't doubt that I said it. It sounds just like what I might have said. So when I came home to throw her out, she had tried to commit suicide by drinking enough booze not to wake up. She did that for 3 days running, and she kept waking up not dead and unhappy about it. And she finally called an outpatient place and checked herself in for some treatment before I got home. And when I came home, she came in. She's still shaking it out, man. She's not inpatient. She's outpatient. She's doing it the hard way. She's seeing things and shaking and having, you know, weird shits going on with her, pardon my language. And she walks in, and I'm still sitting on the couch, and she stands in the middle of the living room, and she said, I know that you told me that if I went anyplace else for help but to you, that I was out, but I couldn't do this on my own. I had to get help. And if that means I have to leave, then I have to leave. That was an enormous act of courage by that woman. What I did instead of putting her out was put her on double top secret probation. That's one foot in the door and one on a banana peel, and we'll see how it goes. Now, I will tell you this, and this is a fact. If you think you're waiting in your life for sobriety to happen with your loved one, whether it's your husband, your wife, your child, somebody close to you, that at the point of sobriety, it's all going to be okay, I bring news. I would rather do the last year of her drinking 10 times in a row than ever again live through the first year of her sobriety. Oh, my God. First of all, What I sent to AA was a drunk woman with a lot of problems, one of which was that she had apparently was a nymphomaniac. Now, when I sent them to AA, I didn't intend for them to address that secondary issue. And what they sent back to me was a woman who said, nope, I'd never done that sober, and I'm not doing it now. Get that thing away from me. I'm thinking, I'm not a big fan of AA, you know. You're supposed to deal with just the drinking. What is this stuff? And she came home instead of passing out every night and let me have the run of the house and have my way with everything and be happy in the morning because I can get all the food and all the anything I want, all the sex I want, because she's sorry every day. For the first year of her sobriety, she doesn't sleep at all. She doesn't sleep. She's awake. And she's got opinions about stuff. And she really needs to share them with me. And I don't want, they told her in AA, her brain's broken. I know broken stuff's coming out of there. I don't want to listen to this stuff. She's following me like Ms. Pac-Man through the house to share these things, and I'm just trying to get away before I put my hands on her because I'm crazy. She chased me out I jumped on my motorcycle and wheelied through a chain-link fence with the gate closed because I knew if I crashed in the gate or if I stopped, I was going to put my hands on her. I had to go. It was nuts. Every Saturday, it's Saturday night at the fight. She's calling Dad looking to go home to Nebraska, and Dad's saying, oh, honey, Jack loves you. You just stay right there. They waited a long time for somebody else to take the helm, and I got the call. So she tricks me into going to AA. She tells me that the people in AA think that you are my imaginary friend. I don't know why that spoke to me, but that struck fear in me. What? If they think she's crazy and they send her home, I got nothing else. She needs to stay there. So I followed her to AA to let you know that I was real so that you wouldn't throw her out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was really concerned with that. And what happened was really interesting. I spent 6 months going to open AA meetings as a guest of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to hear the music of recovery. And the process of recovery is written in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that were given to us for free. I began to hear that in open AA meetings. Those guys in that meeting said things that became enormously important to me. They were then and they are now. And a couple of them, if I remember to tell them all, the first one was a guy who stood up there and he said, I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober today. He says, I have right here, and he put his hand out, I got a stack of solutions to my problems. No matter what happens, I'm going to reach and grab what's on top of that stack. He said, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing on that stack was pick up a drink. I got a problem. I'm happy. I'm sad. It's good. It's not good. No matter what it is, the top thing on that stack is picking up a drink. He said, what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous is you began to put stuff on top of that. Going to meetings went right on top. Being of service went right on top. Working with others went right on top. Doing the steps, having a sponsor. He began to build a stack of things in that stack of solutions to his problems that were between him and that drink was now well down the stack. And what he said was that if I start neglecting my spiritual condition, and, you know, tonight the game's on tonight, I can probably miss the meeting, and I'm sponsoring a lot of people to be taking on another guy, and you know, why don't we let the newcomers have the commitments at the meeting? Every time I do that, one item comes off the top of the stack. And if I continue to do that, there will come a day when a problem comes up and I reach for the stack and drinking's on top. I have to keep that stack loaded with that other stuff because that drinking is still down in the stack, and I never forgot that. But the other one that had a much bigger impact on me was a guy who got up, and I remember his name. I wouldn't know him if I fell over him now. And he said, my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm standing before you in an unnatural state. My natural state is to be more or less insanely drunk, but because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, I get the gift of existing before you in an unnatural state. Because of really good sponsorship and really deep immersion in this program and service and being of service, I've come to the realization that I'm exactly like that guy. I do not have the chemical allergy to alcohol. I have everything else. I have the spiritual malady. I have the mental obsession. The reason the steps work for me is because they were never designed to deal with the allergy. They were always and only designed to deal with the mental obsession, that idea that my mind is going to tell me a lie. What I will tell you with absolute certainty is that the man who woke up on the fifth floor of this hotel this morning, the eyes that popped open and the head that was on that pillow is the guy I've just spent a half an hour describing to you. I'm a man who would be unfaithful to my wife if I thought she didn't love me enough or love me the right way, who would do violence to you if you displeased or offended me, who would steal from you if I thought I needed something more than you. That guy woke up in my room this morning. The maintenance of my daily spiritual condition, because this is something that I never thought I would do in 100 million years, because God went in the ground with that daughter in 1977 and was not coming out. Sorry, not coming out. I got out of that bed and slid onto my knees, and I said a couple of prayers that were given to me by my wife and my sponsor in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been saying those prayers for almost 25 years. I began applying the medicine to my disease to maintain my spiritual condition so I didn't have to be that guy by the time I got to the door of my room and joined you for breakfast in a workshop and for the festivities tonight. And tomorrow I have to do it again. On the day that those things become too much trouble or I'm too busy, I go, I don't have, my recovery has exactly a 24-hour shelf life. That doesn't mean that I get up some momentum in recovery, I'm doing an awful lot, and I can take some time off, and I'm going to taper off, and it's gradually going to get bad. That means at the end of 24 hours, it falls off a cliff. I can't afford that. I've been in the middle of you since the beginning. I have always been in the middle of you because of good sponsorship. I got that lady, I asked her to sponsor me because I had a guy very briefly who had never done the steps and I knew I needed to do the work. She said something to me, which I've been saying ever since. She said, I'd be honored to work with you. That's when my sponsees call me up and they say, they're pretty new, and say, I went to a meeting and somebody asked me to sponsor him. And I said, I need to check with my sponsor. And I tell them the proper answer to that question is I would be honored to work with you. And if they accept that, you better get busy and stay just a notch ahead of them. Bill Wilson had 6 months of sobriety when he carried the message of life and death to Dr. Bob. When Dr. Bob had his last drink, it was 3 days before he carried the message to AA number 3, the alcoholic on the bed that you'll see in AA clubhouses. Time around here isn't important. Momentum is important. What are you doing now? Are you staying ahead of the curve? My sponsor said, if you stay here in that meeting and you're in that chair every week, people, guys are going to show up. They're going to stay. They're going to ask you to sponsor them. You better get busy. She was right, and I did. And I did as thorough a job of the steps, including the men's steps, as I thought I could. She also thought that I needed to be involved in service, and I did every position at the meeting level. And then I started going places. I wound up on the service board, doing jobs I didn't know how to do and was frankly unqualified for. At the end of a year in that commitment, they move you on because by the time you figure it out, you're now dangerous. Rotation of leadership has kept the fellowship alive a long time, because if you leave me in it long enough to figure out how to do it, I'm going to fix it. I wound up as the chairman of the Los Angeles Intergroup in 1995. I was the employer of record for 3 permanent employees at our central office. We had 3 employees answering the phones and distributing literature. I went from there on to the World Service, and I wound up on the board doing hospitals and institutions. I got very involved in California. I was invited by the state to participate as a volunteer in a panel consisting of people from the 12-step programs, advising the Department of Corrections about better ways to get us into the prisons to carry the message of AA, NACA, and Al-Anon, because all of those are active in the prisons in California. We spent 5 years doing that. I was inside of probably 13 or 15 locked institutions with electric fences and machine guns, and I did that as a service commitment. And I'll never forget the fact that at the end of the day, they buzzed them 2 gates open to let me out. Is just seconds and inches, because if I'd have done some of the things I was planning to do earlier in my life, I'd have been on the inside watching the other guy go out through that gate. I went in to help carry the message of those people behind the walls, because believe me, we're in there. We're in there. We're not all of them, but we're in there. We wound up, my wife and I, very busy in Al-Anon and AA. She's on the phone all the time. I hate the phone. I don't want to be on the phone. She's on the phone constantly. I don't know how she does it. I says, if you die before me, I'm putting one in the box with you with a couple of batteries. I'm telling them all to call you because they're going to have to taper off, you know. They're going to put one on your headstone. They can just dial you up down there. But I hate talking on the phone, and I do it because it's a contrary action, and I have to do it to maintain my spiritual condition. And Richard will tell you, and he's a witness to it, I'm on the phone all the time. I don't stop what I'm doing. If there's a serious conversation I do, I'll stop and I'll pay careful attention. But I can continue to do my job I've done thousands of miles on my bicycle talking on the headset because I got one that's designed to absorb the wind. Unless I'm downhill into the wind, we can still talk. Once in a while, I'll say, I'll call you back at the bottom of the hill, and I do. Because I take calls every time they call. It isn't because I'm a spiritual giant. they call me and I sponsor them because I always answer the phone. Do you know how many people around here don't answer their phone calls and don't return messages? I get a lot of them that come from sponsors that when they needed them, they weren't answering the phone. And they say, I'm going with you because you answered the phone. And it's not out of any sense of superiority. I'm just saving my own butt. Because, you know, I suffer from my mental obsession. It's with me every single day. And believe me when I tell you, when the phone rings, I'm fully in it. And I pick up the phone, and there's a crisis to be dealt with, and I divert my attention for just a couple of minutes. And we may or may not make progress in solving their problem, but when the phone call is done, I feel better. Somehow or another, my problems are a little less than they were before I answered the phone, and it's happened every time. My wife sponsored a woman who was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. She'd get drunk, get sober, get drunk, get sober, crank out a kid every year, drunk, sober, drunk, sober. My wife, as her sponsor, was in the hospital, saw two of them born. And she could not get and keep sobriety. And we get really close with the people we sponsor. We thought of that young lady as our child. She was like one of our kids. We would have given anything for that little girl to get sober and to be a sober mom to them kids and have a better life than alcoholism was dictating for her. And at the end of 5 years, she wound up on the street, out of resources. He was gone, the house was gone, the car was gone, the money's gone, everything's gone. She's on the street with four kids. She calls my wife and says, I think I'm really done this time. Can you get me in someplace? My wife got her a treatment bed down at a halfway house in Laguna Hills. I actually transported her down there, a job which I refused to do unless they sent a sober woman alcoholic with me. Because despite my seeming knowledge of the big book and the program, I am unqualified to carry the message of sobriety to anybody. I have an awful lot of knowledge and a lot of experience, but I don't have any experience. I don't have experience as an active alcoholic. I lack credibility. And I took an AA woman with me to deliver her to the halfway house. So through a set of circumstances, there were four kids. There was an 11-year-old who was never, ever going to speak to her mother again. Never. She told me flat out she wasn't. With that child, I enrolled her to go to our Southern California Alateen Conference. It was a big conference in those days. It's still pretty good size. I had never been, but to send her, I had to go as a sponsor. And I enrolled her to go to SCAC, and I went and I sponsored. So they put me in a dorm room with some young men, and I was their sponsor for the weekend. And those are life-changing experiences for somebody like me, because I'm a guy who, after the death of my child, couldn't be around children. It hurt too much. If they looked like my daughter, hurt worse. It was unacceptable. I couldn't go there. And I'm at SCAC working with those kids, and little pieces of me are getting cleaned up that I can't reach any other way. Two of the little girls had to move, one of them in particular. Mom's in the halfway house. She seems to be doing well. My wife's driving 3 hours each way to go read the big book with her, and she tells me that she thinks this might be the time. She's doing pretty good. Maybe this is the one. And the three-year-old staying with a neighbor in the apartment building they'd been evicted from said she can't stay with me anymore. She's got to go. And my wife was looking for some place to put her. And she said to me that they told her at her meeting she'd bring that kid home. And she related a conversation we'd had about us having children. I didn't want kids when I met my wife. My experience as a father was really a poor one. I was an awful father because I'm selfish and self-centered. That was my primary defect of character revealed in my inventory. Those children weren't about me, and I was a terrible absent father and absent husband. And my wife would say things like, you've been in recovery a long time, you'd be a good dad now. And I would say things like, you might be right, but I have no interest in finding out. With that as a subtext, she came to me and she said, they asked if I could bring her home, and I told them that was not going to happen. And what I said to her, because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, this is what I said, and this is not who I am. What I said was, we've been in recovery long enough that I don't think there's anything that we can't discuss. What do you think we ought to do? My wife said, well, what do you think? And I said, I think we should bring her here. And I think we should bring her, she was 3 years old, I think we should bring her 5-year-old sister, because those two seem to be particularly closely bonded. They should both come. That's because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition. These are special needs kids. The younger one more than the older one, really severely affected by mom abusing drugs and alcohol when she was carrying those kids and when she was raising them. 3 and 5-year-old little girls come into my house with a PhD level education in alcoholism. Information that nobody should have to know in a lifetime. These little girls know what it means when the cops go by the house. They know what it means when the social worker knocks on the door. They know what it means when mom's up and in the kitchen and you need to get something to eat now because she won't be conscious very long. These are the lessons these little kids bring into the house. Active alcoholism comes straight back into our house. We took them in for 2 or 3 weeks, hoping mom would sober up, which she had done time and time again. After a month, she looks like she's never had a drink. She would spring back really fast. She was really young, and mom didn't stay sober. 6 weeks of sobriety, her common-law husband picked her up at the halfway house and took her out to celebrate her sobriety by having margaritas. And they went out and never came back for those kids. I don't have time to tell you about the legal battles that happened. I talked about a crisis that happened in our relationship where I thought we might lose it. It was a point where during the trial to adopt the girls because they had no place else to go. And believe me when I tell you, it wasn't because we wanted children, either one of us. My wife had gone long past that. I was not interested in having children. We did that because it was the only right thing to do, and those kids had no place else to go. And my wife said, "What do you think we should do?" And I said, "I think, as far as I'm concerned, I've decided those children are done traveling. They're either staying here or they're going home to a sober mom, but nothing else is going to be acceptable," because they had been every place else. They'd been raised by their aunt and their grandmother and the next-door neighbor when mom was incapacitated or in a halfway house or in a detox or an insane asylum. And my wife agreed, and we agreed to take the actions to do the adoption. And by the midpoint in the trial, it was so painful for my wife that she was ready to quit. And our marriage hung by a thread until, through guidance with our sponsors, we sat down to talk about the problem with the big book of alcoholics, or with the 12 and 12 from AA, talking about the traditions as they relate to the family to solve a spiritual problem, because that's what we were facing. And what happened as a result of that is not only did we come closer together, we became an incredibly effective team in getting help and raising those kids, because that little one was going to be a problem. Now, I have to tell you also that they came to us completely fixated with death and dying. The reason is that the firstborn child of this lady that we're talking about died on New Year's Eve when mom was drunk and dropped her. His name was Matthew. For all the years afterwards and all the children afterwards, she would get drunk and sloppy, and she would tell all these poor little kids about how wonderful their dead brother Matthew was. Everything they're talking about is death and dying. There's a shell around both of them that you can't penetrate. The older one can't make eye contact, doesn't want to touch you, talk to you, or be near you. In order to earn her place in the house, she cleans things. She'll organize a cupboard. She'll straighten a couch cushion. She'll clean out a closet. She can't exist in your world or make that right in her brain unless she does something to make it okay. When we figured that out, we wouldn't let her do any of that. We wouldn't let her take her dishes off the table. How many of you had to stop your children from taking their own dishes off the kitchen table? We made her stop. For her, that worked. She had no other way to belong there, and she had to let that guard down, and she had to let us have access to her and her access to us. That little one was a lot harder. She was really tough and smart. My wife, at 3.5 years old, she put her in a tub one time. By now, she's starting to have violent outbreaks because of bipolar 1. That's manifest with violent outbreaks that require hospitalization. ADHD, medication for that one offends the other one. There's a balancing act. And fetal alcohol syndrome in the middle, which makes every narcotic that you give to a child a wild card. You have no idea. They're not going to react like anybody else. And they had a battle about her getting in the tub. And as my wife got her in the tub and turned to go out, the 3.5-year-old says in a very clear voice, "I wouldn't turn my back on me if I were you." I don't know about you, but that still makes the hair stand up on the back of my arm. This was the circumstances. This is the job that we're taking on as co-parents to parent these kids. The day came around when it was time. It was Memorial Day, a day when I would normally go up to the graveyard and see my daughter's grave and clean it up a little bit. I started doing that every year, at least once a year. I don't think anybody else does. Her mom lives hundreds of miles away. I go up and I trim the grass, and we're debating whether or not it's a good idea to take them kids. And, you know, my problem in my disease is I think I know stuff. They're about death and dying. I don't want to go there with them. I don't want to have anything that brings that up. We're trying. It's finally starting to quiet down in our house, that topic as a subject matter. They know that my daughter died. They would ask me questions like, "If something happened to me, would you be sad?" They were really interested in the answer to that question. And we realized, my wife and I, that we're not God. And we're going to the cemetery, and I got a kid buried up there, and they're going to come with us. We got in the car, and we went up to the cemetery. We're cleaning up my daughter's grave, and I explained to them that two graves over is my 10-year-old godson. My wife, on her first year of sobriety, was in the room watching him be delivered by the woman who was on her last drunk with her, who never sobered up. And we became his godparents. And he died. He had a heart defect, and he died at the age of 10. And I made him open up the cemetery where my daughter was buried. They'd closed a section years ago to put him near my daughter, and we paid for the funeral because the family didn't have the resources because they were all, you know, it was about drugs and alcohol and stuff. They just didn't have anything. I explained that to the kids. Then we went up to the desk up front, began asking questions, and we found out that their brother Matthew is buried 50 feet from my daughter in the same plot. So we walk up there and we find it and we talk about it, and the girls are up there having a conversation. They're 3 and 5. The little one's got that hard acrylic shell around her, and I'm cleaning my daughter's headstone when I realized that I'd forgotten that that day was her birthday. I don't remember which one it was, but I saw that and it hit me really hard. And I started to cry. And I suffer from, as most of us do and that I've ever sponsored, I suffer from an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. You know, I don't want to get them started. I don't want them to see that. This is not good, and I can't control it. And I put my sunglasses on, and the tears are running down my face, and that little one saw it. And she immediately comes over, and I'm kneeling on my daughter's grave, and she sits on my knee. She's 3 and a half. She puts her hand on my chest, and they're calling us Mom and Dad, and she says, "Daddy, don't cry. She'll always be right here in your heart," and she pats my chest. And because she watches us maintain our spiritual condition every day, she says, "Why don't we say a little prayer for her?" And she put her hands together and we said a prayer for my daughter. And that was the precise moment when that hard, impenetrable shell evaporated from that child. It was gone and it never came back. Because I still don't know anything. When I think I know something, it's danger, danger, Will Robinson, the minute I think I know anything. And what I believe today is, and people here tonight will do what happens to me often when I tell a part of the story, will come up and tell me what a hell of a great thing we did for those kids. And I got to tell you, that's not it. Those kids did something for me that nobody else could do. You see, I did the work to clean that baggage out with my daughter. I did exactly what I was told to do. I did all of it, and I did it all the way. And it cleaned a lot out. I did everything that you told me to do to clean that out, but there was pieces still broken in there that you couldn't reach and my sponsor couldn't reach and my wife couldn't reach, was only reachable by those two little girls, and they put those last pieces back together. I'm going to tell you today that those little girls were absolutely right, that I'm a really good dad. I'm a good father and I'm a good husband, and I'm proud of that. I didn't know that that's what I wanted to be when I grew up, but it's what you guys made of me, and I believe today that was my mission in life, was to have this journey to become that. Now I'm going to cut to another piece of the story, which is that when that daughter died, I had a son. He was about 4 years old, and I absented myself from him as well as everybody else. By the time Leslie and I had gotten together and I'd filed for divorce and we were living together, I wound up with him and my sister because my dad lost another house, and my baby sister was the same age as my son. I took him in to raise both of them. Now I'm the dad for everybody because that's what I do. And by then we're in recovery. I'd made amends to my son, and he went on the street. Because he was working on his story. That has nothing to do with me. We got a recovering household, and he went on the street. He wound up with wants and warrants in 7 states. He had bail bondsmen and liked to have a word with him. And he was homeless and missing much of the time. And the first year that those little girls were with us, I happened to have an address where I could reach him. And every year at Christmas time, I send out a newsletter. It's actually like a little newspaper with a comic strip called Leslie's World. It's real conversations with my wife that are really funny. And I put in that letter what's going on. I send out 400 or 500 of them all over the world to people that we meet in recovery. They go to Australia and Europe and Canada and Alaska. They go all over. And I sent one to my son. And I was on my way to my Monday meeting one night, and I'm sitting in the parking lot when my phone rings, and it's him, and he's crying. And he's still out there doing what he's doing. It turned out he was drinking. And he's crying on the phone, and I said, "What's going on?" He said, "You know." I said, "Maybe I do and maybe I don't, but I think you have to tell me." He says, "I got your letter today." in that newsletter was a picture of me in a 6-foot-tall Easter bunny suit delivering baskets to those little girls, because I'm a good dad. Well, my son said, where the F were you for me? Now, I had made amends to him as directed by the sponsor as completely as I could, and I knew that he had to do his story without my intervention, and I stayed out of all of that stuff. But we had a really rough and rocky relationship. He'd be homeless for periods of time, and if he didn't call us, we got no way to reach him. And he called me up, and he read me up one side and down the other, and I'm watching the door to my meeting. It's right there. And I can do this and not say anything and take what he's got to say and not tell him anything, not argue with him, say nothing. The most important communication skill I ever learned from you was when not to. I said nothing. I let him have his way, and it was rough. I know relief is right there. And when he got done and was taking a breath, and I said, you know, I deeply regret that that happened, and you're right, that's stuff that I did. But I'd like to do something about it, and if you're willing, I'd like to start talking to you on the phone at least once a week. What do you think about that? And he agreed. We began building a relationship as a direct result of having those kids and sending out that letter, a relationship that we had never had before. And here's what happened, and this is really important. Alcoholism is still actively killing members of my family. My brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, my grandparents are all gone now. Alcoholism has been devastating my family for years. Nobody's ever gotten sober but my wife. And I would give anything to help them, but I know because of being with you that I'm the only one that can't help them. My family can catch recovery from me, but it will never come through their ears. It will never be as a result of me telling them or explaining anything to them, but there's the slightest chance that they'll catch it through their eyes by watching the way that I live my life. And on the day that my son wound up in jail, he had sampled sobriety for a while and it didn't work. He wound up in jail in central Nebraska. He'd finally gotten a job after years of being unemployed. He was going to be able to feed my grandkids. I had 9 and 11-year-old grandkids back where he was living in Oregon, and he had a real job. And he went to the bar to have a few beers and got in a knife fight, and they busted him on 2 felony counts, and he was going down for a while if they followed through. And he's called me from jail on Halloween morning, and he said, Dad, I got this job. I'm in jail. If I don't show up for work in the morning, I'm going to lose that job. Do you think you could bail me out? And what I said was what I learned from you guys. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And I didn't explain it, which is enormously important. I don't have time to tell you why. Take my word for it, that when you state a boundary, make a decision, and you explain it, it's out of your own insecurity, because if I can get you to agree that it's the right decision, I'm okay, and I don't have to do that anymore. If I'd have explained it, I'd never heard from him again in the jail. Instead, he said, okay, and he called me every day for about a month until he finally called and he said, Dad, I know I'm in here because I'm an alcoholic, and I've checked this town. There's no AA in this town, Shadron, Nebraska. I had 22 Narcotics Anonymous meetings and 1 AA meeting with no contacts. He says, I don't know what to do. Can you help me? And I said to him what you guys taught me to say, which is, no, I can't help you. But maybe I know somebody who can. And because I do service in Al-Anon at this level, this allows me to travel and have a network of people around the world. That's not an exaggeration. There's not any place that you can go that I might not know somebody because of my service in Al-Anon. I called a guy almost 800 miles away from him in eastern Nebraska who sponsored about half the state. His name was Dick Martin. And Dick, we were friends with Dick for a long time because his wife Peg had helped my wife when her dad died back in 1991, had been really instrumental. And I told him what was going on. I said, I need an alcoholic who can take calls from my son in jail. He can call them, but it has to be on a landline, has to be collect. You can't call a cell phone, they won't let him, and it's expensive. Do you know somebody? And he said, I'll get back to you. An hour later, the AA delegate from Nebraska called me and said, what's up? And I told him, and he said, here's my number. I'll take his calls. And I said, do you know anybody up in northwestern end of the state, up in Dawes County? And he said, I'll look into it. And the very next day, 2 men with big books took the message of recovery into the jail where my son was, where there'd never been an AA meeting. Later this month, if he doesn't get drunk between now and then, that boy's going to celebrate 5 years of sobriety. Partially because I know absolutely because of you that I don't have the ability to help him. I can't help him. I can help your kids. I can't help my own. But because of my association with you, I know that there's people all around the world and in this room tonight who would do anything to help my children. And they have. And I would do anything to help yours. Thank you for your hospitality.